Happy New Year. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. This is a passage from Viktor Frankl that I've shared and referenced an untold number of times over the past few years. It serves as a reminder to slow down and breathe, and that we always have a choice about what we do when something pokes at us. As Stephen Covey wrote with the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, we have response ability, the ability to respond and to do so thoughtfully. At its best, it's a sacred space full of possibility and, yes, responsibility. And it's an opportunity to lean into our C3 value of well-being, which reads, we promote wellness and wholeness of mind, body, and spirit, recognizing our self-responsibility, interrelatedness, and interdependence. That space between stimulus and response is, in large part, about recognizing our self-responsibility, our interrelatedness, and our interdependence. It calls us to consider beyond ourselves while also being self-aware. But how do we recognize it? To recognize implies a relationship. So how do we enter into relationship with our self-responsibility, our interrelatedness, and interdependence? There are lots of ways to approach that question, and this morning I'm going to explore one that's guided by even more questions. The seeds of this talk have been brewing since I attended Nadia Bolz Weber's Red State Revival in Grand Rapids at Fountain Street Church this summer. If you're not familiar with Bolz Weber, here's how she describes herself. Foul-mouthed for a preacher, grammatically challenged for a best-selling author, surprisingly hopeful for a cynic. Grace is the source code, but snark is the gift. So my expectations were in a particular place, right? With that kind of provocative biography, I was actually surprised, although I shouldn't have been, at how grounded she was and what a sacred space she created in what was the biggest crowd that she had had to date on her tour. She wasn't 10 minutes into talking before she offered up a series of questions that have been rattling around in my brain ever since. I'm going to offer those questions to you, along with my personal thoughts and experiences with them. There are probably more personal stories in this talk than I've ever done to date. And I'm primarily sharing when I got it right. But for every time I got it right, there were probably 100 times when I totally messed it up. My single hope is that as you listen today, you find something in here that provokes something in you and that shifts your perspective in a meaningful way. In preparing to share with you today, it became clear that these questions are, at their heart, about setting boundaries, checking our motivations and ego, and noticing where we need to let go of control. All things that we work on throughout our lives. Let me first say that each of these questions starts with what's mine. I'd like to suggest that in this case, mine means it's where my gifts and interests intersect with the world's needs. What comes naturally to me? What resonates most with my heart and soul? So with that in mind, let's consider that first question. What's mine to say? Here's where I landed. It's mine to say if I can add to the conversation. I'm not repeating or diverting because my ego needs to be heard. It's mine to say if I can be useful in a way that is uniquely suited to me. When I see something, I can say something if that something reflects my life experiences or expertise. I can say something if I can be useful by using the simplest words possible when I'm not sure what to say or when the focus clearly needs to be on someone else. Thank you. I'm sorry. I'm here. I'm listening. Would you say more about that? What do you need right now? How can I be useful? How are you? I love you. What about you? How do you determine what's yours to say? Discerning what's mine to say isn't quite as simple as I'm suggesting, but it's often clearer than the next, more complicated question. What's not mine to say? When I was in fourth grade and I got my first library card, they made a mistake embossing my name on the card. Instead of it reading Beth Mount, they embossed Beth Mouth. My mom took one look at it and quipped, "How did they know?" Kind of an ouch. Clearly, I was a talkative child. As I grew older, I'm sure I became more circumspect, but I also came to understand that the person who talks and is listened to has power. I discovered I liked that feeling, not in a "I must have power" kind of way, but more in a "it feels good to be listened to" way. So I got better at saying stuff, and I became more outspoken, more opinionated, and fairly confident I was right most of the time. I don't think I was arrogant, at least I hope not. I just felt the compulsion to speak my mind every time I had a thought that needed to come out. I at least had to make my case, as anyone who has served on the C3 board with me can attest to. Sometime in my late 40s, I sensed I was developing something of an edge, an impatience, and that didn't sit well with me. Then one day I realized, I don't have to share every opinion, idea, or thought that comes into my head, even if a little part of me died every time I held back. I realized that there were some things that were not mine to say, or at the very least, didn't need to be said. And since that sort of duh moment, my stress has decreased and my well-being has increased. I've learned, and I'm still learning, the art of letting go. I'm more discerning about when I speak up. I still say a lot, ask my husband, but I ask myself, in that space between stimulus and response, if I'll be adding value or just speaking from my small, insecure ego that needs to be heard. I was fortunate that I had a few years of practice finding my mute button because it came in handy this summer during the time I spent with my parents. My parents' health issues had been escalating for years, as they do as we get older. But they came to a head in April. I was talking to my mom about an emergency appendectomy I had had a few months prior. I said it really taught me to listen to my body and not hesitate to get help just because there was this chance that it would be nothing. She mentioned that she had been having neck pain and that it was getting worse, but she had not been to the doctor yet. I decided it was mine to say, "As soon as we hang up, I want you to call the doctor." That started a chain of events that led to a cancer diagnosis, surgery, and rehab for my mom, and a lot of driving south to Kentucky for me. It meant more time alone with my dad than I'd had in decades. I'm grateful for that time because the tables turned dramatically once my mom returned home from rehab, and my dad had to be admitted to the hospital for an infection. He spent the next few months in and out of the hospital, but mostly in. I tried to time my visits for when I would be most useful. His condition worsened over the summer, and by September, things were undeniably serious. That was the first real test to see if my mute button worked. There were many moments in the days and hours before my dad's death that I struggled to know what was mine to say and what wasn't. Between my intuition and what I knew about his condition, I felt pretty sure that when I left for Bowling Green on September 17th, that this was a farewell tour. Various conversations I'd had with Dad left me at peace with our relationship. Small grievances had been made right, and I didn't feel much, if anything, was left unsaid. I felt kind of as ready as you can be to say goodbye. It was clear when I arrived in Bowling Green that my mom was not in that same headspace. This wasn't surprising at all, and I did not expect her to be. She was living in hope, even as she was grounded in reality and understood the situation. Here, I had to resist, because of where I was in my head, my urge to bring her fully 100% into reality, which was my initial impulse. I was coming from a place of love, and wanting to move from pain, both hers and my dad's, into acceptance. But had I come in with a let's get real agenda, that would have done irreparable harm. There are two conversations that I'll always remember, and they illustrate this power of knowing when something isn't ours to say. It's a flat-out miracle that I was able to hold myself back. As you listen to these two stories, I invite you to consider times when you have been in a similar dynamic with someone. The first conversation was about my dad's wishes in the absence of a written advance directive. Mom said they talked about it years ago, and I asked her what Dad said about what he would want in this situation. She said, he said, I'd want to live. By this time, he was in the ICU, half his body weight, on a ventilator, and not responding to dialysis. He couldn't communicate much except squeezing our hands in response to questions that we would ask. So when my mom told me he'd said, I'd want to live, I was filled with sadness. Did I say what I immediately thought, which is, how would Dad define living? While lots about my dad was mysterious to me, I knew two things for sure. Living for him was my mom, and traveling, being out on the open road. But I didn't say anything. I knew it wouldn't be a welcome question at that moment. I think I just said, okay, and went silent. Mom then talked about possible tests and treatments, about what might have a chance of getting him out of the hospital and into rehab and eventually home. When we returned to his room, she held his hand, told him he was doing great and to keep fighting. Sometime the next day, she noticed how lost Dad seemed, and she said, this isn't living. That opened the door for me to say, I was wondering about that. And we had an honest conversation that allowed us both to test that reality waters. That awareness, this isn't living, was not mine to say or share. It belonged to my mom, on her time and her terms, as the person who knew him better than anyone else in the world. Later that same day, we got Dad's brother on the speakerphone. And I can already tell I'm gonna get emotional, so apologies in advance. He told Dad he loved him, to fight like hell. Don't give up, you've got to fight. His heart was in the right place. But again, I listened with renewed sadness, wondering silently if that was what Dad needed to hear right then. Sorry. The next morning, his mom and I drove to the hospital. She said, I was thinking last night, I think we're sending the wrong message, telling him to fight. Maybe we need to let him know it's okay. I was astonished. Not that my mother would come to that conclusion, just that the shift had happened so fast. I think we both felt like a weight had been lifted. I learned that I didn't need to say something or be responsible for her awareness. I don't have to be responsible for anyone's awareness. I can only show up as a witness and companion, ask questions, and be present to someone as they form their own awareness. There are more stories from that experience, including how my dad's kidney doctor stepped in to say what was hers to say that only she could say, and what a gift that was. But I'll stop there, as I'll probably keep crying, and you get the picture. I'm guessing everyone here has experienced a variation of this story. Maybe it was a situation with a parent, a partner, a friend, a sibling, a child. You realize that your opinion or your helpfulness was better kept on a back burner. You knew the other person had to find their own way, no matter how uncomfortable it might feel. Feeling into what is yours to say and what isn't is the work of a lifetime. I'm starting to think that a good default is, when in doubt, leave it out. If it's truly yours to say, say it. But if you even feel a slight hesitation, let it go. Let the other person find their own words. Sure, you might chime in after that, but you will have given them space to figure something out for themselves without short-circuiting their process. Another way we can check in with ourselves is to ask, is this the hill I'm willing to die on? Because that's what's at stake, with the death being that of trust, safety, connection, or even the entire relationship. The next question that Nadia Bolz-Weber suggested was, what's mine to do? You could also put it as, what's my work to do, or what's my self-responsibility? So many people think that they have to do it all. When they follow that feeling, however, they become overwhelmed or stressed or even hopeless, which is likely opposite of their intent. That's why asking ourselves more specifically, what's mine to do, is so important. So I need to go back to Kentucky and my time with Mom and Dad. Dad died on the morning of Saturday, September 20th, and there was a lot to do immediately. While I wanted to be useful in the midst of so much grief, there was little of those tasks that I could do. My work in that moment was to offer emotional support. A few hours later, after the initial steps had all been done, there was nothing to do but wait for other people to do their part. The question bubbled up again, what was mine to do? I doubt I was asking myself in those exact words, but I suspect the idea was kind of humming in the background as I thought about, how can I be useful? I found myself checking movie schedules. And then I asked my mom, do you want to go see a movie? She didn't hesitate. Her response was, yes, that's a good idea. That's how we came to be at a matinee showing of Freakier Friday on the day my dad died. What was mine to do? It was mine to give us permission to take a breath, to make it okay to step away from the doctors and the hospital and the most intense adulting that you'll ever have to do in your life, to offer Mom, at least for a few hours, some normalcy, even though an undercurrent of grief was there. There was going to be plenty of time for grieving. I poked around after that to see how I could more directly help her, but I didn't get very far. Mom would tell me in so many words, that's not yours to do. But when I offered to research the million things that have to be tended to after a spouse dies, she took me up on it. The resulting spreadsheet made me feel like I'd done something that was mine to do that was also useful to her. So that was a win-win. And that's part of the key to discerning what's ours to do. Consider where a need intersects with your gifts, maybe even your zone of genius, as some people call it. What can you do that feels easy, that might be difficult for others? What feels natural, like a heart-led contribution? What might bring ease or peace to another person? By now, you can probably guess the next question. What's not mine to do? Here's the short answer, at least for me. It's not mine to do that which I know others want to do or are good at. It's not mine to do anything that denies someone else the opportunity to use their gifts or to have self-responsibility or agency. It brings to mind a very useful phrase that I have to keep reminding myself. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. I've mentioned ego a few times, and this is where it really shows up. Maybe something isn't yours to do because you're more motivated by ego than altruism. On some level, known or unknown, you're letting your ego lead. Ego can show up as virtue signaling, wanting to have control over another person or the situation, or wanting to be the hero, to be the person that saves the day. I'm not passing judgment on any of that, because who among us hasn't, at least once, done something in part because it tells the world, see, I'm a good person. We might have also been motivated by fear or guilt or shame, which feels justified because we want to atone for any transgressions. These are all human responses when we see a need, especially for the smart and socially aware among us. We will step in to do what's not ours to do, even though we're not coming from the healthiest place. This is the opportunity to hear that voice that says, here, let me do it, and be able to respond quickly with, wait, is this mine? Is there someone better at this or who would enjoy it more? Where is this let me coming from? Am I trying to prove I'm worthy? Even within the scope of what's ours to do, not everything needs to be done by us. At a point when attacks on LGBTQ rights were at the top of the news, a friend who cared deeply about it said that she felt quite helpless compared to the need. But she decided that focusing on the bigger picture would paralyze her, so she committed to supporting those within her immediate circle with meals, rides, hugs, and I love yous. The small deeds that speak volumes. She knew something important. When we try to do what's not ours, we risk running out of capacity to do what is ours. So now we get to the final set of questions that might make us squirm a little bit, or at least they had that effect on me. What's mine to care about? This might be the easiest question to answer, actually, as we often collapse care with love. There's likely a universality to what people care about, our family, both our family of origin and our chosen family, the work that we have chosen, the way we contribute to the world. We might fold in the issues that matter to the people that we love the most. We care about our pets, our home, our neighbors, our health, our well-being, our choices that have an impact on others. What's mine, what's yours, is to care about what's aligned with our personal values, something we talked about in pre-talk. We care in the best way possible when we work within our values and our circle of influence. We can't get caught up in not being able to care about certain things as much as others do. Those are theirs to care about, and we have ours. It's not a competition. And every ounce of care, wherever it's given, counts. And so that brings us to the final question that I think is the squirm-worthy one. What's not mine to care about? Note that that's not the same as, what do I not care about? It's more, what's not mine to care about? And that's not to rush away from what's mine, but this is the messier place for self-examination. And I love it, Valerie brought up in pre-talk, if I'm not breaking the bubble of confidentiality, she said, what's not mine to care about? What other people think. And I was like, oh my gosh, I can't even believe I didn't think of that. As somebody who's over 50 who decided at some point, I don't care what people think. But we do. I mean, we still do. But it made me think that maybe that sort of freedom is the gateway to clarifying what's ours to care about and what's not ours to care about. I mentioned neighbors a few moments ago. Our neighbor in the house right next door to us has some mental issues. They're in their mid to late 80s and live alone. When they're on medication, chance encounters are benign. When they're not, the paranoia leads to visits from the police, various utility companies, and maybe a relative or somebody from their church. We are in touch with their family, and we know that they are trying to help, but their assistance is often rebuffed. State and local social service agencies have been contacted over the years, but nothing substantive has happened yet. Andy and I realized a few months after moving in, 8 years ago this weekend, that we needed to keep an eye on them and be aware of the vulnerable person in the house next to us. We wanted to stay alert, and we didn't want to get involved. We cared as one cares about a neighbor and their safety and well-being, but their situation and the solutions to it, they were not ours to care or worry about. What was ours to care about? How we could be mindful and compassionate during any interaction, to reach out to her family if anything concerned us, like when a caregiver and her children moved into the house and we questioned whether they were squatting and taking advantage, which they were. What wasn't ours to care about was and is the solutions or how quickly things move. It's just not our business. There's a line we won't cross, not because we're heartless, but because it is not ours to get involved with. Because that's often what it means to care, to do something. As I shared before, we can't do everything. It's contrary to our well-being to love or be concerned about absolutely everything. When we tip over into caring about things that aren't ours, we again risk our capacity to give adequate care to that which is ours. Another lesson from my mom. One particularly poignant moment happened between me and my mom when I was visiting her in November. We were in the kitchen, and she was showing me a box of items that she had been collecting that represented what made Dad, Dad. She picked up a pill case and talked about how they had like 7 or 8 of them, you know, like those daily pill cases. They would sit down at the beginning of the month and, like an assembly line, fill the pill cases with all of their various medications. She said, "I'm going to keep one of these pill cases because it was such an important part of our routine, but I'm not keeping the rest of them. I have to figure out what's sacred and what's not. I can't keep everything." Again, I was astonished. We might believe that care and love can't and shouldn't be rationed, but that's a bit of what I'm suggesting we consider. It's okay to personally consider some things sacred and to acknowledge and let go of what's not. The good news is that not everybody cares about the same things. What's not yours is someone else's, and so we can take some comfort in that. To close this question of what's mine to care about and what's not mine to care about, let's introduce even more philosophical ambiguity and consider the A.A. Milne quote that's in your bulletin. "Some people care too much. I think it's called love." I feel torn about this quote. To me, love is caring enough that we open-heartedly place someone else's well-being above our own. We support their growth, we walk alongside them and share the load, and we respect their individual journey. Healthy caring and love is beautiful, and we'd like to all think that that's what everyone gives and receives. But we know that's not always the case. We might idealize and project virtues onto a person who is sacrificing everything for someone else, assuming they're selfless and driven only by deep love. In reality, there could be other motivations to their caring, such as the ones related to ego that I mentioned before. In those cases, caring too much can be oppressive to the recipient and self-serving to the caregiver. I admit that my interpretation, that latter one, is a little cynical, and you might completely disagree with me. But it doesn't matter if we agree. What matters is that we pay attention to these messages, like love means never having to say you're sorry, that we get from society, pop culture, et cetera, that are just tossed around and sneak their way into our belief systems and are rarely questioned because they sound logical on the surface. And besides, what kind of monster questions Winnie the Pooh? Did you know Winnie the Pooh was going to be mentioned twice this morning? I had no idea. But if we're going to discern what's ours to say, do, and care about, we have to embark on our own journey of discovery and be okay if our truth goes contrary to popular expectations. We have to challenge our assumptions and realize that our well-being is dependent on being able to embrace what is ours and release what isn't. So this is a difficult talk to wrap up. Believe it or not, I have reams of other thoughts and stories and information that I could have shared. A lot is left on the cutting room floor, but I'll spare you and I'll leave us with this. Each person has to decide for themselves what's theirs to say, do, and care about. To help with that, we can ask ourselves some simple but not easy questions. For example, who does my action or response serve? Me or them? What's my intention behind my response? How much of thy intent is tied to honest, non-agenda-driven love? And how much is about ego, or control, or fear, or shoulds, or obligations, discomfort, or anxiety? And what does my answer to all of those tell me about what's mine and what's not? When we explore these points, we're doing an alignment check. Does our response keep us in sync with our soul, our spirit, our energy, or whatever we call that inner being? We're testing it out if our response contributes to growth and freedom or if it limits us and those we love. I also appreciate this perspective from a YouTube comment on a video about Elizabeth Gilbert's memoir, All the Way to the River. The commenter wrote, "I work in a very traumatic field of human services, and one thing I try to knock into people's heads is someone else's tragedy is not your adventure. I see too many others trying to be a main character and romanticizing pain they cannot understand. We don't need to be the hero in someone else's story. If we pause in that space between stimulus and response and ask ourselves, is this mine? We will be a step closer to the well-being that's possible when we practice a deep level of self-awareness and self-responsibility. The final thought I'll leave you with is the idea that we don't have to take on the world in order to be worthy of love and kindness. That's why I chose the poem in your bulletin. I hear in it a reminder that our presence and honoring our interconnectedness and interdependence is enough. We are enough. So I'll give our poet, Denise Levertov, the last word. As swimmers dare to be faced to the sky and water bears them, as hawks rest upon air and air sustains them, so would I learn to attain free fall and float into Creator Spirit's deep embrace, knowing no effort earns that all-surrounding grace. Thank you.